From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Guerlat, Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. At the museum in Washington, D.C., more than 2,000 names are etched on a memorial to journalists who died reporting the news. For some reporters, it's personal.
When attackers came in and bombed the newspaper, obviously in places like Pakistan and elsewhere, the stakes are much, much higher.
Longtime newspaper editor and now college dean Ed Kelly joins me to talk about the dangers of international journalism. We'll also discuss the evolution of foreign reporting.
Some really good regional papers, for example, that may have had four or five or six correspondents based in key parts of the world, whether that's Mexico or Israel or Russia or London or wherever, a lot of those positions have gone by the wayside.
That conversation is coming up right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat. This half hour, I'm joined by Ed Kelly. He's currently the dean of the Gaylord College of Journalism and Mass Communication. But before that, he spent decades as a newspaper editor and reporter. Ed Kelly, welcome to Worldviews.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you here, Dean Kelly. I really want to focus on some of the global issues that journalists face around the world. But let's just start with some of your own experience. The fact that you've obviously been a journalist for your career. You've worked in a lot of diverse markets, Washington, D.C., Oklahoma City, Salt Lake City, mainly in print media. But I know you have some background in broadcast and digital work. But just from your career, you know, what are some of the changes you've seen in terms of how, you know, journalists and journalism has changed, how journalists have to do their job a little differently, access to global news and global information, and how that has influenced what you report in a local setting like Oklahoma City or Salt Lake City, for that matter?
Well, certainly the way that people consume news has radically changed. I like to tell people that we're 20 years or so into what I call the digital revolution. And beforehand, of course, people like me, we were gatekeepers. There was a limited amount of information that the public was aware of. You had three nightly network broadcasts every evening. You had a daily newspaper in a very dominant daily newspaper in every market. You could also get news by in an old-fashioned way by AM radio in local markets. But for the most part, those were the sources of information that most people had. Well, with the advent of the Internet, of course, that has all changed, and news consumers here in Oklahoma and elsewhere can get on to their heart's content and access news from news organizations like the BBC, Al Jazeera, news organizations, the South China Post, news organizations really all over the world at any time, day or night. So the free flow of not only information but news to consumers is like I said, radically changed, and has changed just when you measure it on the cosmic scale of things, has just changed almost overnight. As we know, most Americans are not consumed by what goes on internationally unless there's some sort of a crisis. We recently have had the bombing incident in New York, what possible ties it may or may not have to the Middle East. People obviously are interested and very interested when news like that breaks, and then it sort of wanes and goes away for a while. That's unfortunate, I think, but I do still think that most Americans understand that they can't isolate themselves from the rest of the world, and that people, whether it's a time of crisis or not, educated Americans know they need to understand something about the rest of the world. So local newspapers, though, and local broadcast affiliates, because, again, there are so many ways to get news and information in this day and time, probably have less emphasis on international and global news than they did back in the day when they were the sole source of news for their particular markets. So that has changed quite a bit. It still doesn't mean, though, that news organizations, at least responsible ones, what I call serious journalism, that they have abandoned that. It's just that there's probably less emphasis on it today than ever. And also, too, with the changing business model, not just for print-oriented organizations, but broadcast, too, there are probably fewer correspondents representing American media outlets around the world than there used to be. And that's true in almost all of the organizations that I'm aware of, some really good regional papers, for example, that may have had four or five or six correspondents based in key parts of the world, whether that's Mexico or Israel or Russia or London or wherever. A lot of those positions have gone by the wayside. But there still is a commitment by the really outstanding news organizations such as the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, CNN to keep Americans apprised. But again, the depth of reporting, because of the change in the way that the business is structured, and that that basically the business of news is much less profitable than it once was, means that invariably there are going to be reductions in force in putting people in interesting and or dangerous spots around the world.
Well, so much of what you said here is so interesting and worthy of a follow-up. I mean, where do I begin? Because, I mean, you've touched on some really important things, and something actually I just learned from you. I mean, I've noticed that my local media definitely doesn't cover international news. And I just thought, well, you know, maybe they're just not interested. But it's because, like you just said, the notion that people can get that news and other sources. So there seems to be an effect on the business of media. And let's make sure we know that it is a business. The media industry, that it will pick and choose. And focus on comparative advantage. My comparative advantage is what I know here locally. And because you can get all this news now from around the world, that, you know, allows me to limit my focus to something, because I don't have to cover what's happening in other places because I'm not the only source of news anymore. I mean, I don't know. That just hadn't really dawned on me that was kind of a conscious decision to let other people cover the international news.
Yeah, that's right. I hate to use the word commodity, but in some ways, international news and certainly a fair amount of national news is a commodity. And so news organizations, as they struggle to reinvent their business model and stay relevant in their communities, have decided to focus on what they do best, which is news and information in their own backyard that only they, in many cases, can provide. So it's not that they're not interested. It's just simply they've been forced to do this, as well as we all know that if there's an international story breaking right now, the internet, social media will provide tons of information coming right at you, almost as if you're drinking from a fire hose, and you can get that at any time. You don't need to rely on the next newscast at, say, 6 o'clock tonight, or certainly not tomorrow morning's newspaper. You know, it used to be many years ago, 100 years ago, that news was broken in newspapers. And then in the 1920s, here came the advent of AM radio. Well, then after that, in the late 1940s and 50s, here came television. The big change really happened, I think, in the 1980s with the advent of cable television, which became the source of breaking news, whether that's a local story or somewhere halfway across the world. But today, as we know, all news is really broken on social media. And even cable news struggles to stay relevant in what I would call the breaking news game. So,
but as a professional journalist, though, I mean, does this concern you that obviously news breaks very quickly and from multiple sources and isn't always as professional, perhaps, as a trained journalist? I mean, everyone's a journalist now, right? You're out with your cell phone and you're capturing video or photos or images of things or reporting on them, writing your own blog, whatever it is. I mean, you referred a few minutes ago to serious journalism. I mean, is this serious journalism? And how are serious journalists dealing with the fact that people around the world are just breaking news to us all the time, 24/7?
Well, it is difficult, and it is it is painful at times to watch and see in those first few moments after a big breaking story, usually something involves violence, that there are inaccurate reports that get aired and or are on social media sites. And I cringe, like you suggest, as a lifelong journalist, that this is happening, knowing, of course, too, that journalism, credible news organizations make mistakes as well. It's not just citizen journalists, but others do too. I think, though, for most organizations, that it's important to get it first, but it's more important to get it right first. And so I think the traditional news organizations understand they're in the breaking news game, but at the same time, don't want to be associated with anything that could be construed as something that's not accurate. I think we all need to remember, too, that local law enforcement authorities particularly, but others who are involved in emergency situations, that they are very reluctant to release information unless it's been thoroughly vetted. And so you have this period from either a few minutes or in some cases a couple of hours where there is really no official information that citizens can rely on as absolutely what we would call the gospel truth. And so there is a lot of conjecture that gets made to fill airtime and or feeds and posts on social media. And that's where credible news organizations are on somewhat of a slippery slope when they try to compete with others who are not terribly concerned by that.
Well, this issue of credibility is certainly important. And I mean, it's no secret that credible journalists, professional journalists, have been involved in long-term investigation stories, breaking really important and life-changing news like Watergate, for example, and more recently, things like Snowden. Journalists were right on the forefront of that, breaking that story. I mean, people who have really important things to communicate often do go and communicate them through professional, credible journalists and news sources. How has that affected the industry and as being seen as a way in which, you know, oftentimes unpleasant things have at least unpleasant to perhaps government authorities are often the subject of what journalists do. That relationship, I guess, between officials, you know, elected officials and the public and, you know, journalists who are working in an industry and in business and are professionals, and how that, symbiotic relationship emerges.
Yeah, this is really nothing new as long as there's been, whether it's pamphlets way back in the day, 200 years ago, to the advent of the so-called penny press in the 1830s and 40s. And then, of course, in the 20th century with the advent and domination of broadcast media. Because most Americans still say that they get most of their news today from over-the-air television, broadcast television, which is fine. But good journalists, particularly those that are investigative journalists, have always had a relationship, sometimes a good one, sometimes a very tense one. It runs hot and cold with the sources, with the people that they cover. There are also, too, at every level of government, people who you can call them whistleblowers or whatever you want to call them, who either do it for the best of reasons or nefarious reasons or somewhere in between, that are willing to release information that, as you suggest, sometimes either angers and or embarrasses government at any level, particularly the federal level. So we can go back to Watergate. We can go back particularly, I think, particularly salient in this day and time, are the release of the Pentagon Papers in 1971, in which Daniel Ellsberg, the former RAND Corporation analyst, released a treasure trove of papers and data that really detailed the early involvement of the United States in the Vietnam War and how the Nixon administration tried to prevent the New York Times from publishing the information. A celebrated court case, certainly a celebrated case in American journalism history, in which the Times won the case that prevented the government, in this case, again, the Nixon administration, from using prior restraint. So there's always been this tension, and contrary to what most people think, sometimes the tension is just as great in Democratic administrations as it is in Republican administrations. And certainly that's been the case, I think, in the Obama administration that has cracked down on whistleblowers. And some people have compared it in some ways, the current administration, to that of the Nixon administration. So, again, sometimes conventional wisdom doesn't always rule in this, but sometimes sensitive stories can only be done with people who are on the inside, and that's why news organizations always struggle with what are the motives of these people. That's first and foremost. What kind of protection or anonymity do we give people like this? And those issues, even with the changing ways in which news and information is delivered, those are age-old issues that have been around for a long time, and I would contend will be around for a long time to come. Newsrooms wrestle with that all the time.
My guest is Ed Kelly, the dean of the Gaylord College of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Oklahoma. After a short break, we'll talk more about some of the dangerous work reporters do covering international stories in some of the world's most tumultuous regions. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation. You can download this episode and leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU and at Suzette Corlott. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlott, the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. I've been talking with a fellow dean, Ed Kelly, who leads OU's Gaylord College of Journalism and Mass Communication. Before that, he spent a majority of his four-decade career as a reporter and editor with The Oklahoman, eventually rising from summer intern to editor-in-chief. Just before the break, we were talking about how U.S. media have evolved over the past two centuries. Well, Ed, we've been talking largely about American media, or at least Western media, the mainstream media here in this country. But you also referred to earlier some of the dangerous work that reporters do. Certainly, you know, journalists in the United States are traveling around the world, those, you know, kind of working on their own or for news sources, whichever it may be, media outlets, putting themselves in harm's way. We definitely know that that American journalists have died, you know, trying to write their stories. But this is true of journalists all around the world as well. You know, there are journalists in many countries that are putting themselves in harm's way to try and break news and tell the truth and shed light, you know, which is, I think, what journalists do day in, day out, shed light on things that we need to know, that they think are important and issues they find important. And so, you know, as an industry official and as a professional journalist, you know, how do you deal with this sort of thing? And how do you train your students to manage this sort of thing? And, you know, is this just a workplace hazard and it's just something that you're going to have to deal with? Or are there movements to try to enhance security for media professionals as they go about shedding light on some of these important issues?
Well, obviously, reporting in dangerous places has always been a dangerous line of work. There were approximately 80 or so journalists who were killed in World War II. The most famous of those journalists, the late Ernie Pyle, was the last one who was killed. He was killed in April 1945. Right before the end of the war. So being in harm's way is an occupational hazard, and certainly journalists who agree to do this, whether they be reporters, photographers, videographers, or the like, you know, they accept the risk. I don't know of any journalism organization, whether it's in this country or anywhere else, though, that would deliberately put an employee, one of their people, in harm's way if they felt like that harm could come to a person. I can't imagine that happening, and I know that it doesn't happen with news organizations here. And I don't think it happens anywhere else. But this is a particularly dangerous time to be a journalist in the world, and in places where you might least expect it. For example, in Turkey, since the failed coup. Of course, Turkey has never been terribly friendly to the dissemination of information, but it really has ratcheted up its case against journalists since the coup earlier this year. There's a group based in New York called the Committee to Protect Journalists, and they've done a lot of sort of research here of late into what's going on there with journalists, and says that they've in Turkey they've closed down more than 100 broadcasters, newspapers, magazines, publishers, and the like. Detained more than 100. They detain approximately 100 or so journalists a month. Courts, regulators have censored at least 30 or so news-related websites, and all kinds of security forces raid newspaper offices on a regular basis. And this is in a country that is a NATO ally. So you can imagine what it's like in places that are much less friendly to the work of journalists than a NATO ally. So far this year, there have been 30 or so journalists around the world who have been killed in the Iraq war, which stretched out, as we know, over the course of several years. There were between 70 to 80 journalists that were killed. The jailing of journalists, just like in Turkey last year, for example, the two companies that shared the notoriety of having the most journalists jailed were Egypt and China, which obviously is a world power, and I think a lot of your listeners would not think that that would be a place where it would happen, but it happens on a regular basis there. Some might remember, too, the case of Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post reporter who was jailed in Iran on some trumped-up espionage charges. He was in jail for more than 540 days before he was finally released early this year. He benefited from the fact that he had a very strong news organization with a great international reputation behind him that could put pressure on public officials in not only this country, but obviously in Iran. But there are still probably a third or more of the people who report in dangerous places are freelance journalists. And so they don't have the benefit of having a strong news organization with its resources behind it like Jason Rezaian did with the Washington Post. So freelancers, who have always been a part of reporting internationally, are particularly vulnerable at this point in time. If I might share one story with you, we at Gaylord College have a great relationship with the United States State Department. And we work with state to, for example, bring working journalists from other countries into the U.S. And over the last year or so, we brought several groups of journalists, both print and broadcast, from Pakistan to the United States. One of the things that we do when they are here, when they spend a few days in Washington, besides spending some time here in Norman, is one thing I like to do with them, which is take them to the museum, the great museum in Washington that basically is the history and the story of news and how it has evolved through the years. On the third floor of the museum is a memorial. It is simply called the Journalist Memorial, and it chronicles the deaths of every journalist around the world over the last 12 or 15 years. When I take these journalists from Pakistan up to the third floor, invariably almost all of them go up to the walls where these names and photographs of these journalists from Pakistan are, and they tell me stories like, he was my friend. I had lunch with him yesterday. He left a wife and two little kids. He was about ready to leave his shift when attackers came in and bombed the newspaper. So it really is sobering for people like me, journalists in this country. I've told people, and I've told these Pakistanis, that really the worst thing that could happen to me as a journalist working in this country is that I would get sued by a lawyer. Obviously, in places like Pakistan and elsewhere, the stakes are much, much higher.
Well, Ed, thank you so much for being here today and shedding some additional light on your industry, on media. Clearly, those of us who are interested in things around the world, we rely on you and your colleagues to know what's happening. And so thank you for sharing these stories with us today.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to my conversation with Ed Kelly, the Dean of the Gaylord College of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Oklahoma. You can download this episode at kgou.org or subscribe to have the show delivered to your desktop, tablet, or smartphone each Friday. KGOU produces Worldviews with the support of OU's College of International Studies. Sam Dupre produces the show, our research is prepared by Katie Holland, and Brian Hardzinski edits the interviews and writes our digital content. We'd like to thank our intern, Audra Bruhls, for all her hard work this semester. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and thanks for listening.